This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello and welcome back to The New Scientist, starting off this week with the cover story of this issue about the ancient sea peoples. They came by sea. It is one of the greatest mysteries of ancient history. Who were the sea peoples blamed for the destruction of a string of civilizations 3,000 years ago? Ramses II was one of Egypt's great warrior pharaohs. A temple he built at Medinet Habu near the Valley of the Kings highlights why. On its walls, carvings tell the story of a coalition of fighters that swept across the eastern Mediterranean 3,200 years ago, destroying cities, states, and even whole empires. No land could stand before their arms, this account tells us. Eventually, the invaders, known today as the Sea Peoples, attacked Egypt. But Ramses III succeeded where others had failed and crushed them. In the 200 years since hieroglyphics were first deciphered, allowing us to read Ramses III's extraordinary story, evidence has come to light to corroborate it. We now know of numerous cities and palaces across the eastern Mediterranean that were destroyed around that time, with the sea peoples often implicated. So widespread was the devastation that, for one of the only times in history, several complex societies went into a steep decline from which they never recovered. Little wonder, then, that this so-called Late Bronze Age collapse has fascinated scholars for decades. So, too, has the identity of the mysterious seafaring marauders. Today, new genetic and archaeological evidence is giving us the firmest picture yet about what really went on at this dramatic time, and who or what was responsible. This shows that many of our ideas about the sea peoples and the collapse need complete rethinking. It also hints at a surprising idea. The end of civilization might not always be as disastrous as we think. Before the sea people arrived, life was good in the Late Bronze Age of the Eastern Mediterranean, if you were an elite member of society, that is. During this period, between 1550 and 1200 BC, kings from Mycenaean Greece in the west of the region to the rulers of Babylonia in the east lived in opulent palaces, taking advantage of a thriving trade network to procure all the luxuries of the time, from gold and jewels to ivory and fine wines. Collapse of civilizations. Then things fell apart. In Mycenaean Greece, where there were a handful of small kingdoms, the palaces were destroyed and the nature of society completely changed. There was an end to fine craft production, says Guy Middleton at Newcastle University in the UK. The Mycenaean tradition of writing ended too, with their script, Linear B, falling out of use. The chaos wasn't confined to the Mycenaean world. Notably, the powerful 450-year-old Hittite Empire that controlled most of Anatolia, roughly corresponding to modern Turkey, fragmented. In fact, some researchers think that most cities along the Anatolian coast and down the eastern shores of the Mediterranean were destroyed. This included Ugarit, a city in what is now Syria, and here there seems to be clear evidence of what went wrong. Several archives in cuneiform, another ancient writing system, have been unearthed during excavations at Ugarit, and some of the texts appear to be letters composed by Ugarit's king, Amurapi, just before the city's downfall. In one, translated in 2016, the desperate ruler writes that the enemy forces are stationed at Rasu, one of the ports of Ugarit. In light of such evidence, it is easy to see why many researchers think Ugarit was sacked by a seafaring force, most probably the sea peoples described in engravings on Ramses III's temple. These warriors were credited with incredible strength by the ancient Egyptians. Not a single Egyptian foe has ever been assigned such powers. Never has an enemy been described as the destroyer of empires. wrote Shirley Ben-Dor Evian at the University of Haifa in Israel in a 2018 study of ancient Egyptian texts. But who were these people? Even today, the question lacks a definitive answer, but a handful of ancient clues are helping to build a clearer picture. A good starting point are the battle scenes carved on the temple. These show that one group of fighters in the Sea People's Coalition wore horned helmets and carried long swords and round shields. This gear, reminiscent of the stereotypical idea of a Viking warrior, is unlike anything used by combatants in the Eastern Mediterranean Bronze Age, but it had been seen in Egypt before. Similar equipment was carried by invaders who had assaulted Egypt a century earlier, and who were depicted on monuments left by the pharaoh in charge at that time, Ramses II, who named the attackers as the Sardana. For obvious linguistic reasons, researchers suspected that the Sardana hailed from Sardinia, suggesting some sea peoples had roots in this island off Italy, or southern Italy more generally. But we can't be sure of the link, says Reinhard Jung at the Austrian Academy of Sciences. He points out that there are no Sardinian texts from that time, so we don't know if the locals used the name Sardana to describe themselves. The archaeological evidence is largely lacking, too. There was an unfortunate religious habit in southern Italy not to place armor in the tomb, says Jung, which means we don't know whether warriors from this region really did wear horned helmets. Swords from the area do, however, look like those carried by the Sardana, as depicted on the Egyptian monuments. There are other reasons to suspect that the Sea People's Coalition included a southern Italian contingent. Many settlements in that area were attacked and destroyed in the final centuries of the Bronze Age, possibly by invaders from northern Italy. And if the southern Italian settlements were destroyed, perhaps their inhabitants were forced to flee. Jung says it would make sense for them to sail to a region they knew, either to raid the land or to search for new homes. Significantly, in the past 20 years, we have new evidence that the southern Italians traded with the eastern Mediterranean, and so must have been familiar with the area. For example, we now know that a distinctive style of pottery that began appearing in Mycenaean Greece towards the end of the Bronze Age, known as handmade burnished ware, was southern Italian in origin. And in 2019, an analysis of ancient DNA showed that pig bones found at one Mycenaean palace had a genetic signature suggesting the animals came from Italy. With evidence like this, a tentative explanation for the late Bronze Age collapse emerges. The communities of southern Italy were uprooted towards the end of this period. They moved east, and either deliberately or inadvertently, destabilized the kingdoms of Mycenaean Greece. As those so-called palace economies quickly descended in chaos, many Mycenaeans lost their homes too, swelling the ranks of the displaced. The coalition of migrants continued pushing along the coast in search of new homes, destroying cities and states in their path before they met their match while attacking Egypt. Ramses III's temple seems to provide more support for this narrative of destructive migrants. The pharaoh named one of the groups in the Sea People's Coalition as the Peleset. Today, many researchers identify the Peleset with the Philistines, who lived in a region, Philistia, now chiefly encompassing the Gaza Strip and parts of southern Israel. Importantly, it has long been suspected that the Philistines were foreign invaders who took Philistia by force roughly 3,200 years ago. Moreover, many researchers argue that the Philistines hailed from Greece because some of their pottery looks Mycenaean. In 2019, genetic evidence seemed to confirm this link. An analysis of ancient DNA showed that four infants who lived in Philistia about 3,100 years ago had a genetic signature linked to places in southern Europe, such as Greece and Sardinia, indicating a wave of immigrants to the region. For decades, however, there has been no good explanation for why such chaos and mass migration would have unfolded quite so dramatically. But here, too, recent research provides some clues. Several studies have concluded that the Mediterranean experienced a centuries-long mega-drought at the end of the Bronze Age. The suggestion is that this triggered chronic food shortages and social unrest, priming the region for the collapse of civilizations. But for a growing number of researchers, this sounds more like a Hollywood plot than an account of real history. They argue that a more critical examination of the evidence suggests that there was, in fact, no destructive wave of migrants sweeping across the Mediterranean and no centuries-long drought. In fact, some even doubt there was a late Bronze Age collapse in the sense of a single region-wide disaster. People turn this up to 11, and we have to take it back down to 3, says Jesse Millick at Leiden University in the Netherlands. Re-examining the evidence. To begin with, Ramses III's evidence about the nature of the Sea Peoples becomes more opaque under cross-examination. There is notorious ambiguity in ancient Egyptian texts, which makes them tricky to interpret. Ben Dor-Evian's 2018 reanalysis suggests that the pharaoh actually meant the Sea Peoples were in fact employed by the Hittites, rather than destroying them. And a 2022 study made the case that the term Ramses III used to describe the Sea Peoples' chiefs suggests they were more likely to be leaders of bands of pirates than a formidable army. Even with those more nuanced interpretations, it is never wise to build the foundations of history on words approved by a pharaoh. Doing so would be the equivalent of a future historian trying to understand the 21st century world solely by reading an account endorsed by Russia's President Vladimir Putin, says Sturt Manning at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. It would give you an odd view of events, he says. Moreover, researchers have taken the accounts on Ramses III's temple and hyped them up further. Some have argued that the Sea Peoples were responsible for the destruction of the Mycenaean kingdoms in dozens of cities, including Ugarit, in the eastern Mediterranean. But Ramses III mentioned few of these places in the list of sites he says the Sea Peoples laid to waste. Worse, many of them may have not been razed at all. Over the past few years, Millick has re-examined the field notes taken years ago as these places were excavated. At most of them, including those in Philistia that the Philistines supposedly took by force, the evidence for destruction is weak. At Ekron in Philistia, for instance, there is just a single burned storage building. As such, Millick doubts the Sea Peoples were really a cataclysmic force. What then did happen? By abandoning the story that the Sea Peoples are responsible for a wave of destruction, alternative explanations become available. These include the idea that each kingdom and city collapsed independently because of specific local factors. At first glance, that sounds implausible. So much chaos occurring simultaneously is surely no coincidence. But in reality, the timeline of these events is probably more relaxed than that. The destructions in Mycenaean Greece could have taken place over 15 or 20 years, says Helene Whitaker at the University of Gothenburg in Sweden. Across the region more broadly, it might have occurred over 50 years, says Manning. Hardly evidence of a single acute crisis. Moreover, says Millick, for all we know, there is a relatively high level of destruction throughout the 350 years of the late Bronze Age, meaning it might not have been unusual for several cities to be under attack at any given time. Significantly, earlier this year, researchers announced the discovery of a cuneiform tablet unearthed in the Hittite city, which describes how four cities, including the capital, Hattusa, are in disaster. It was written 200 years before the late Bronze Age collapse. New analyses of ancient climate are also making a region-wide crisis seem less likely, although some studies appear to show that the Mediterranean experienced a centuries-long drought that began roughly 3,200 years ago. Manning says this idea is misleading. It is based in part on analyses of ancient pollen, which can reveal shifts in vegetation in response to changes in conditions. But most of these are low in resolution, with potentially decades separating data points, so they don't provide a full picture. It's only when you have high-resolution sources, ideally annual data, that you see there's a great deal more complexity, says Manning. Last year, he and his colleagues published a dataset capturing climatic conditions 3,200 years ago near Hattusa. This came from analyzing tree rings and ancient juniper logs to assess changes in rainfall from year to year. It showed there were plenty of wet years in Anatolia at the end of the Bronze Age. The analysis did find evidence that Anatolia experienced a devastating three-year drought between 1198 and 1196 BC, coinciding with the demise of the Hittite Empire. But Manning and his colleagues concluded that this was on its own, probably doesn't explain that collapse. It is significant, they argue, that the Hittite royal family had splintered a few decades earlier. This meant that the drought hit while the empire was politically weak and less able to cope with problems such as food shortages. It isn't just squabbling royals who can contribute to the fall of a civilization. Middleton suspects that the general population, too, may sometimes play a part. For example, he says that when the Mycenaean palace states collapsed, many of the non-palatial rural communities of Greece continued apparently unaffected. We don't know why, but one possibility, first suggested by Jung, is that it was the general population, rather than invading sea peoples, who destroyed the palaces. The idea is that they did so because the ruling elites had become too oppressive. It might be that most people were glad to be rid of the palaces, says Whitaker. This take on the late Bronze Age collapse is arguably the most radical of all. We might like to imagine that a society capable of producing opulent architecture and written records is fundamentally better than a society lacking these features. As such, it is tempting to interpret the disappearance of sophisticated societies as evidence of an unexpected and unwanted catastrophe. But we forget there is an alternative, says Millick, that people may choose to stop building palaces and keep written records because they want a more egalitarian and uncomplicated society. Even today, many people say they would love to give up the trappings of modern life and go back to something simpler, says Millick. It is conceivable that some of the Bronze Age inhabitants of the Eastern Mediterranean, including the Sea Peoples, felt the same way. We still have plenty to learn about the dramatic events at the end of the Bronze Age, but as the evidence continues to accumulate, we may finally be able to acquit the Sea Peoples. It is possible they have been framed for crimes that may never even have happened. Now to the next featured article about everyday toxins. Forever chemicals are finally being recognized as a danger to our health. But given they are woven deeply into our lives, can we ever be free of them? In 1938, chemist Roy J. Plunkett stumbled across a substance that would change the world forever. He was experimenting with refrigerant gases when he noticed that one compound had transformed into a white, waxy solid. It had extraordinary properties, being impervious to heat and chemical degradation, and also extremely slippery. Today, we know this chemical as Teflon and produce more than 200,000 tons of the stuff every year. It is used in everything from nonstick frying pans to medical catheters. Though undoubtedly useful, Teflon is also the first of a group called perfluoroalkyl and polyfluoroalkyl substances, PFAS, better known as forever chemicals. Almost as soon as Teflon was invented, concerns were raised about its potential impacts on the environment and our bodies. It is worth noting, though, that these days, using nonstick cookware is probably safe, as the pans are heat-treated and don't release any nasties unless they are left on a high heat for too long. Today, the world is finally getting to grips with just how dangerous forever chemicals can be to our health, and dealing with the problem head-on. In January, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, added 9 forever chemicals to its list of hazardous constituents. And last month, the U.S. imposed its first-ever limits on levels of PFAS in drinking water in a belated bid to reduce exposure to these ubiquitous chemicals. But what risks do they actually pose, and what should we be doing to remove them from our lives? Researchers face a huge challenge in finding the answers, but are starting to make real headway. PFAS are a diverse group of about 16,000 artificial chemicals used in a vast array of products. What they all have in common are fluorine atoms attached to carbon atoms. To qualify as one of the PFAS, a molecule must contain at least one fully fluorinated methyl or methylene group, a carbon atom with all of its available bonds occupied by a fluorine. The name Forever Chemicals is derived from the fact that they are incredibly stable, immensely heat tolerant, resistant to chemical degradation, and also thoroughly repellent to water and oils. This combination of properties makes them useful in all sorts of applications, from nonstick cookware to outdoor clothing, stain-resistant furniture and carpets, food packaging, personal care products, paints, varnishes, and firefighting foams. But it also means that they inevitably leak into the wild. They hang around for a long, long time, hundreds or even thousands of years, according to Zhang-Yong Wang at ETH Zurich in Switzerland. PFAS pollution has been found extensively in surface water and groundwater, soils and outdoor air, and has adverse effects on wildlife. It can cause suppressed immunity and reproductive issues in some animals, even at tiny concentrations. These chemicals are also found in sewage, house dust, indoor air, and drinking water. A study last year found that PFAS are in almost half of all tap water in the U.S. Unsurprisingly, they are also present in the human body. An estimated 98% of the U.S. population have detectable concentrations of PFAS in their blood, says Karsten Pross at Johns Hopkins University in Maryland. Not only do we drink them and inhale them, we also eat them in food that has been wrapped in PFAS-contained packaging, grown in PFAS-contaminated soil, or caught in PFAS-contaminated water. They are eventually excreted in urine, but only slowly. In the human body, they take between a few months to 5 years to halve in concentration. Being so ubiquitous, rates of excretion can't keep up with rates of acquisition, so the older we get, the higher our PFAS load tends to be. Disrupted metabolism. Being so stable and inert, the prevailing view is that these chemicals couldn't do much harm. That is no longer the case, says Birgit Gücke at the Food Packaging Forum in Zurich, a nonprofit organization governed by independent scientists. While human enzymes can't degrade them, PFAS can interact with biological systems by binding to cell receptors and other proteins, and hence disrupt metabolism, she says. There is ample data that certain PFAS are linked to cancer, immune dysfunction, kidney disease, and more. There's increasing evidence that there are toxic effects on a variety of levels, says Prass. PFAS are already regulated to a degree. Two of the ones about which the most is known, perfluorooctane sulfonic acid, PFOS, and perfluorooctanoic acid, PFOA, have been included in the Stockholm Convention on Persistent Organic Pollutants, which severely restricts their use. Others are being considered for inclusion, says Denise O'Carroll at the University of New South Wales in Sydney. Many countries have limits on the amount of PFAS allowable in food and drinking water. But these measures are akin to shutting the stable door after the horse has bolted. In 2022, Ian Cousins at Stockholm University in Sweden and his colleagues found that levels of PFOS, PFOA, and two other PFAS greatly exceed advised limits in rainwater, surface waters, and soils globally, and that this probably applies to many other PFAS too. More recent research by O'Carroll found that a substantial fraction of source waters around the world exceed limits for PFAS in drinking water. That doesn't necessarily translate into unsafe drinking water, as many water treatment plants remove some PFAS. But O'Carroll points out that drinking water standards usually only cover a fraction of the 16,000 PFAS that are out there. Canada, for example, has one of the strictest drinking water limits in the world, no more than 30 nanograms of all PFAS combined per liter, but only monitors 18 of these chemicals. As a result, the U.S. government recently announced more than $1 billion of funding towards addressing contaminants like PFAS in drinking and wastewater. Two powerful U.S. agencies are also stepping up their efforts to phase out PFAS, and the EU is attempting to ban them outright. One major mover and shaker is the EPA, which recently put restrictions on PFA levels in drinking water after studies showed that no levels of exposure to PFOS and PFOA is safe. It has also added 9 PFAs to its list of hazardous constituents, the first step on a potentially torturous path to designate them as hazardous waste and hence strictly regulate their manufacture, use, and disposal. It appears the EPA is moving more aggressively to get PFAs out of our environment, says Greg Scobleet at Verisk, a New Jersey-based company that advises its clients on emerging risks. To be listed as a hazardous constituent, scientific studies must show that the chemical is toxic, cancer-causing, leads to changes in DNA, or causes developmental abnormalities in humans or other animals. In the case of PFAS, unfortunately, some of these criteria are met, says Prass. The question of what these chemicals actually do to our health is complicated. For ethical reasons, you can't expose a certain population to PFAS and others to a placebo. Instead, EPA scientists assess the peer-reviewed literature on PFAS, including data from human epidemiology and animal studies, which together attempt to draw connections between exposure to PFAS and health problems. For example, by measuring vaccine responses in children versus the levels of certain PFAS in their blood. Among the 9 chemicals that the EPA decided to take action against was PFOA, which was widely used for decades in furniture, clothing, and food packaging before its use was restricted globally in 2019 under the Stockholm Convention. The EPA concluded that humans regularly exposed to it are at greater risk of high cholesterol, liver damage, thyroid disorders, testicular and kidney cancers, preeclampsia, pregnancy-induced hypertension, and low birth weight. They also experience a weaker response to several vaccinations. Studies on monkeys, rats, and mice found similar problems, plus kidney toxicity, liver and pancreatic cancer, and congenital conditions. The EPA published similarly detailed reviews of 8 other PFAs. That's all the time we have for this week. Thank you very much for listening.